It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Compared to other mental health conditions, schizophrenia can be difficult to treat. But over the last couple decades, researchers at the National Institute of Mental Health have found that a combination of early intervention and team-based mental health services is effective at managing symptoms. Unfortunately, not all patients have gotten to take advantage of the new approaches to care. Our next guest will give us some insight into the barriers that stand in the way of effective schizophrenia treatment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you or a loved one been diagnosed with schizophrenia or experienced psychosis? Were you able to get some kind of help or treatment? Did you run into roadblocks trying to find and access treatment? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Ron Diamond is a professor emeritus of psychiatry at UW-Madison and was previously medical director of Journey Mental Health, formerly Mental Health Center of Dane County. Ron, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you.
There are a lot of misconceptions out there, I think, about what schizophrenia actually is. Can you start us off by talking about the symptoms and how we diagnose it?
Well, first of all, nobody believes that schizophrenia is really one illness. It's more like saying pneumonia. And there are lots of different kinds of pneumonia. There are probably lots of different psychopathologies or brain problems that lead to schizophrenia. But the overall issue is that there are typically people who are suffering from psychosis, hearing voices, believing things the rest of us don't, often complicated by what we call negative symptoms, difficulty with motivation, difficulty with inertia, difficulty with feeling pleasure, and then further complicated by cognitive problems, confusion, problem with executive functioning, organizing things. And different people have different parts of those symptom complexes to different extents.
Can you talk a little bit about what that does, what challenges that raises for people in their daily lives?
Well, it makes everything more difficult. It could make it difficult to continue with school. It can make it difficult to hold a job. It can make it difficult to maintain social relationships. It can make it difficult to just go to a grocery store or to plan what you want for dinner. And as a result, many, but not all people with schizophrenia have trouble just with daily functioning and with keeping housing and with things the rest of us take for granted. Now, when I talk like this, I want to be clear that there are some people with schizophrenia who do quite well. There's a TED talk by a woman by the name of Ellen Sachs, E-L-Y-N-S-A-K-S, who is professor at UCLA with schizophrenia and talks eloquently about her own illness. But for the most part, it's a really difficult thing to live with.
How has treatment for schizophrenia developed, maybe even just since when you first started practicing medicine?
Well, when I first started practicing medicine, the antipsychotic medications were just coming out, and that was considered a dramatic and miraculous cure. But what it really did was it let people with schizophrenia to be more tractable and to some extent to get out of the hospital, but it didn't necessarily improve their quality of life. And different medications, which had better side effects, still didn't seem to affect the core elements of the illness. Beginning in the early 70s, a team-based approach was developed, actually with much of the work going on here in Madison. The primary person who drove a lot of this was my mentor, Len Stein, now deceased, and found that if you combine the medication with help with problems of daily living, help with job support, help with figuring things out, interventions that help people deal and live with their symptoms, which were not necessarily going away, then people could be much more stable and have a much better quality of life, even if we didn't know how to cure the illness. Many parts of medicine with chronic illness, we don't know how to cure, we know how to manage. We don't cure diabetes, we help people manage it. And there were a lot of experiments about combining psychosocial treatments with medication that showed we could help people manage their illness, much better quality of life. It was really a fairly dramatic relook at what this was all about.
Dr. Ron Diamond is with us, professor emeritus of psychiatry at UW-Madison. We are talking about schizophrenia, how Treatment options have changed, improved over the years, but not everybody has access to that kind of treatment. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you have a question for our guest or maybe an experience you're willing to share. That's 800-642-1234. Can you talk around a little more about how this team approach works? Who are the different parts of this team? How do they interact with that person who's seeking help?
Well, in the traditional treatment, we would expect somebody with schizophrenia to come in for an appointment. We would see them briefly for a medication check every month or two, and then we'd be surprised that they wouldn't keep taking the medication. They would have trouble with daily function, and it wasn't considered our job as psychiatrists or even as mental health people to intervene very much. The team approach said, instead of looking at what we normally do, let's look at what this person needs. And that might mean putting on the team somebody who could help maintain housing, somebody could help the person get a job, somebody could coach the person about social skills training, how to make eye contact, how to say hello, how to do those things that got lost in the course of the illness. It might mean helping people learn to go grocery shopping by going grocery shopping with the person. It was a lot of very hands-on, immediate work that operated often 24 hours a day or 7 days a week, of which the psychiatrist and the nurse, who were important parts of this team, were only one important part. And so the whole team worked together to try and compensate and help the person with these disabilities manage their disabilities.
I think I can guess one obstacle here. From insurance companies, they might be willing to say, okay, you saw a doctor, they prescribed a medication, we'll cover that. This other stuff might fall outside of their purview. Is that one of the challenges, just finding insurers who are willing to cover that broad spectrum approach?
Absolutely. I always got frustrated because as a physician, I could write for very expensive medication. It could cost $1,000 a month for medication I was writing, and that would be covered without a hiccup. But to write to say this person needs a job coach or this person needs help learning how to go to the grocery store was outside the purview of what most insurance companies would even consider as medical, even if it was as important or even more important than the expensive medication.
Is that changing at all?
I would like to say yes. In the public sector, it's changing a lot. So that the first teams of this sort, actually the first team in the world was here in Madison in the early 70s. And since that time, the public sector, Medicaid, SAMHSA, and state funding agencies have recognized this. And every county in Wisconsin now has what's called a community support program that operates with these principles. Pretty much every state in the country has at least some of these teams operating. It's really worldwide. It's been implemented in different ways, but with the same basic principles, all in the public sector. Medicaid, which doesn't pay very well, and the reimbursement rate is a problem, for the most part, will pay for these team approaches. And there are a lot of grants, block grants to states that will pay for it. As far as I know, almost none of the private sector insurers, traditional insurance, will pay for the array of services that are needed. And so if you happen to be unfortunate enough to be middle class or wealthy, if your kid is a young adult covered by your insurance and you have traditional insurance, you're probably out of luck. And in fact, I have on many occasions suggested that people let their kids get off their family insurance and go into Medicaid, which is the only way to get any kind of team approach, as far as I know.
Now, as you said, this was first being worked on in the 1970s. So we have about 50 years of practice on this. What kind of changes do you see in health outcomes for people who are able to access this team approach and this broader approach that helps them live hopefully better lives?
Well, if you have the full array of services, the employment rate goes from 15% of people with schizophrenia to more than 50%. You see people staying in school, which makes a huge difference. You see people, for the most part, not being homeless. You see people having stable lives. Everything is more difficult if you have schizophrenia, just like it is with other chronic illnesses or chronic conditions. But you see many, many more people with this disorder having lives that are tolerable, that are generative, that are productive, and that make sense to people. Without this, and it really requires an ongoing lifelong approach, when the team stops providing support, people typically have trouble making it on their own. The level of support can vary enormously. Schizophrenia is a relapsing illness, so for periods of time, people might need a lot of intensive support. It might be multiple contacts a week, and then people might be doing better and really only require a contact or two a month. But the risk of a relapse going up to requiring more support is always present, and therefore the team has to be somehow available pretty much indefinitely. And with this, you find that arrest rates go down, jail rates go down, hospitalization rates go down, emergency visits go down. It's kind of a win-win. We just don't know how to politically pull it off.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Brian is with us in Stevens Point. Brian, hi.
Hi. I was calling just because I dealt with my dad, who had bipolar, and he was living with that for 25 years or 30 years, and he was so difficult for our family to deal with. We lived with it, and we almost affected us as much as him after a while.
Brian, thank you so much for sharing that, and I'm sorry for what you could hear it, a difficult experience. I understand, Ron, in some programs there is family support, not necessarily just for the person dealing with, in Brian's case, his dad had bipolar, he said, or schizophrenia, helping family members as well for their own benefit and maybe for their loved one's benefit as well.
It's a critically important part of that. It's not a surprise, by the way, that at the same time the first teams were developing in Madison, Wisconsin, the National Alliance for the Mental Illness, a family support group, nationally had its first meeting, organizational meeting here in Madison. And the two, I think, coincide that schizophrenia and other major mental illnesses can present huge burdens to the families and to other members of the community. And part of what this team does is focus on the needs of the patient, the person involved, but part of it is focusing on the needs of the family. I can remember one young woman with bipolar disorder who was incredibly disruptive, and the family needed to set limits, and they didn't know how to do it. And they were able to start applying limits and to say that she couldn't live there and actually kick her out of the house, because they knew that our team was in a warm car sitting outside the house waiting to make sure she had housing that night. And the team working with the family as well as with the patient can really help deal with some of the burden of this. Now, I don't want to promise mm-hmm. that there isn't huge burden in any case. There's not a clear cure, and families are going to be stuck with an overwhelming amount of stress, and the best team in the world can't do it all. But these teams, when they're functioning appropriately and when they're working with the family as well as the patient, can sometimes help huge amounts. We could go with examples where the team has not been able to do that, even if the team is available, but it does help a lot for a whole lot of these families, which right now are stuck doing it all by themselves. If the patient, the father with bipolar disorder, doesn't come in to see the psychiatrist and doesn't follow up, the family is stuck all by itself. And if the team is involved and has a relationship, the team should be out there in a car waiting for the person and helping the family deal with the crisis.
Brian, thanks a lot again for sharing your family's experience. We're talking to Dr. Ron Diamond, Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at UW-Madison, about schizophrenia treatments and obstacles to receiving care. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you experienced this in your family? Have you yourself or a loved one had access to this kind of team approach to care? What kind of things did you see working that helped? What questions do you have about schizophrenia? Do you work with patients with the condition, one form or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up the conversation with Dr. Ron Diamond, Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at UW-Madison, former medical director of what used to be the Mental Health Center of Dane County, now called Journey Mental Health. We're talking about barriers that people with schizophrenia could face in trying to access the most effective medical treatments, often team-based treatments. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you received or participated in this kind of team-based care for schizophrenia or other mental health conditions? Did that support work for you? Is this something that's affected your family? And what questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's bring on another caller. Dorothy is with us in Greendale. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi. My daughter has schizoaffective disorder, which is bipolar with bouts of schizophrenia that are related to the manic phase of her disease. And I live near Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and she is now under the care of a team approach through a program in Wisconsin called Family Care. And it is a part of Medicaid sponsored by the state of Wisconsin. And it has really made such a difference in her ability to cope, to manage with the schizophrenia has decreased amazingly. And these professionals come to her home because she has been in a wheelchair and oxygen, but she has lost 170 pounds. And can now walk with a walker, and is, for the first time in like 5 years, she's starting to go out to AA meetings and just be a part of the world. She's 53 years old.
Dorothy, thank you so much for sharing that with us. A lot of the elements there, Ron, what do you want to focus on?
Well, Family Care is an umbrella, almost HMO-type organization that organizes services, and it sounds like they are in that area as well as here, providing a lot of these wraparound in-home services. The certified programs in Wisconsin that do the full team approach are called CSP, or Community Support Programs, or the less intensive programs, or CCS, or Comprehensive Community Care. But this has been so effective that lots of other programs in the public sector, not in the private sector, have picked up elements or pieces of this, whether they are formally certified as CSPs or not. And when it happens, then the chance of it working goes hugely up, as you mentioned.
And Dorothy,
and part of this is going on site, not waiting for the patient necessarily to come into you for an appointment, and really being tenacious about following through. Almost all of the patients that I worked with that eventually did well started by saying, I don't have anything to do with you guys, I don't want to take the medication. And you get a relationship by taking people grocery shopping, or by taking them out for food, or by continuing to visit. And so the idea is, we're going to work to develop a relationship despite initial reluctance on the part of the patient. And we're going to do it voluntarily. We're not using legal coercion in most cases. And it can be very effective.
Thanks again for that call, Dorothy. And another thing Dorothy mentioned, and you just referred to, that services come to her daughter. And I've seen this as a common theme. If you're saying to somebody with schizophrenia, okay, you've got to come to this appointment with a psychiatrist, and then go see your work coach, and then go see your housing coach, and so on. For somebody with, as you mentioned, some executive function concerns, that can be overwhelming, I would guess.
It can be. I grew up, my father was a GP in a small town and always did house calls. And as a kid, I remember going on house calls with him. And I thought all doctors did house calls. I was abused of that in medical school. But part of this was doing house calls and having the whole team do house calls. And it's not that every patient needs that. It's expensive and time consuming. But for those that do, it's the only way to connect.
If there's somebody out there listening, getting treatment themselves for schizophrenia or for a loved one and not familiar with this concept, wondering where they can go to see what resources are out there, if there's something for them, where would you recommend they start?
I'd go to the County Human Services. There is supposed to be a CSP team in every county, and it's under the direction or authority of County Human Services. Some of the rural counties have put different counties together to form a team, but that would be where I would start.
Now, with our system, some states, I believe including Illinois, have said, hey, insurance providers, you do have to cover these wider treatments, these team approaches. Is that an effective way, you think, to improve access to this sort of treatment?
I like the idea. I actually do not know how well it's working. So I can't comment on how well it's working in Illinois, but I think getting people to cover needed services makes sense. We wouldn't cover surgery for cancer, but not cover oncological treatments of other ways. I think that that's the way to go. I don't know how well it's working.
And finally, I'm wondering, do we have enough trained people? Do we need to expand the network of the various kind of providers involved in this team service?
Always, yes. There are two issues with that. One is there's a shortage of mental health professionals, including psychiatrists and trained therapists. But the other is the training required for this kind of work has to be a little bit different. Many psychiatrists are not really trained to work with these teams, not trained to work with people this seriously ill. And also many psychologists and nurses and social workers don't have the appropriate training to do this kind of work, which is really quite specialized. Just one example, we train almost all therapists now how to do cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. But there's very little training for the specialty CBT of working with people with psychosis, which is evidence-based, has a manual, and yet it's really very few people, clinicians, are exposed to the specific requirements if you're going to apply this to people with psychotic disorders.
Ron, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's Dr. Ron Diamond, Professor Emeritus of Psychiatry at UW-Madison, previously Medical Director of Journey Mental Health. We talked to him today about schizophrenia treatment and why the most effective care is difficult for a lot of patients to access. If you or someone you know is struggling or in crisis, there is help available. You can call or text 988 or chat 988lifeline.org. Remember, you can follow these conversations all the time, anytime, online at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Time now for Food Friday. These days, we don't actually need to preserve meat or fish to make it through the winter. We can just go buy some at the grocery store. But our next guests say that the act of preserving can be as satisfying as the food itself. In a new cookbook, the people at the Northern Waters Smokehouse Restaurant on Lake Superior in Duluth, Minnesota, share the craft of smoking and preserving meat at home and lots of recipes to go with it. You could join in at 800-642-1234. I don't smoke or cure meat at home. I know at least some of you do, and we don't give you a lot of opportunities to talk about it. Well, here it is. Call in and tell us about your projects, how you got into it, your favorites, or maybe some advice you need. Join in at 800-642-1234. Or if you're like me and you love eating smoked meats and fish that somebody else made, tell us about your favorites. Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ned Netzel is the co-author of the new cookbook, Smoke on the Waterfront, the Northern Waters Smokehouse Cookbook. He writes for the blog and social media platforms of the Northern Waters Smokehouse Restaurant and has worked a bunch of jobs at the Duluth Restaurant for nearly a decade. Ned, welcome to Central Time.
Happy to be here.
Also on the team, Nick Pelliquin, co-author of Smoke on the Waterfront, kitchen manager at Northern Waters Smokehouse. Nick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Ned, let's start off. Tell us a little bit about the smokehouse itself that inspired the book. How did it come to be? What do you focus on there?
The smokehouse has been here for about 25 years. In its current location, we've been here about 2 months now. We just moved to the basement of our longtime home, the DeWitt Sites Marketplace down in Canal Park. And We're first and foremost a smokehouse, specializing in fish, both, you know, from around the world and also from our own big lake, Lake Superior, as well as meats from, you know, pork to bison. We do salumi, dry cured stuff. We do all sorts of sausages, kind of a little bit of everything. And we make sandwiches with a lot of those materials.
And Nick, smoking and curing, it might sound intimidating for home cooks. Now, they don't need, I assume you've got much fancier cooking than a starter at home would want to have. What are some of the basics that somebody would need to try smoking at home?
You know, to get going, all you really need is a big pile of salt and maybe some special curing salts for certain projects. But, you know, meat, salt, and a Weber grill is really all you need to get going.
What? Yeah. So I have a Weber grill. What would I need to do with that? Do I need to do anything special to make it a smoker, or is it just how I'm using it?
I mean, getting some thermometers for both ambient temperature and then a probe thermometer to check the interior of the meat. But, you know, I've modified my own Weber grill, just a little hole drill on the top to get an ambient temperature thermometer in there. But a lot of them come with them these days. So, you know, you can buy one ready to go right off the shelf.
Ned, I understand the founder of Northern Waters learned a lot of his skills while in the Coast Guard in Alaska. Can you share a little of his origin story and why he decided to make it his life?
I think that while he was stationed in Alaska, he just saw people around him having great success with, you know, smoking their daily catch and making it last for quite a while. You know, that subsistence lifestyle really appealed to him. He grew up in Iowa, and I think he kind of fell in love with fishing and the world around him when he went to the Boundary Waters in his youth. But, you know, that kind of got tucked by the wayside, and then he saw these people around him doing this kippering technique that we talk about. It's the way we smoke our fish here. And he thought, hey, I could do something with this. And he found a market for it here in Duluth, Minnesota.
All right, Nick, what is the kippering technique?
So it's almost a hybrid of kind of a cold and a hot smoke. So you're starting at a really low temperature, about 100 degrees. And you're just ratcheting that temperature up slowly over the course of, you know, 4 to 6 hours. And you know, depending on what you're doing, obviously. But so you're never kind of baking the meat, so to speak. It's kind of almost, you know, a little sous vide, like it's very gentle braise kind of technique. So what you end up with is a really great skin and smoke to the product, but the interior remains really moist and nice and soft texture.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Ned Netzel and Nick Pelequin, co-authors of Smoke on the Waterfront, the Northern Waters Smokehouse Cookbook. That's a smokehouse in Duluth. You can join in. 800-642-1234 is the number. Do you have questions about how to smoke things and make them better? Is this a pastime of yours? Tell us about it. How'd you get into it? What do you like to do? What are your favorites? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ned, I get the impression from the book that behind the scenes at the smokehouse, there's a lot of fun and inside jokes behind the names to your sandwiches and listening to Tom Waits while you smoke stuff. Take us behind the scenes, what it's like to work at the smokehouse.
Well, that's a really great question. It's, you know, we are a pretty standard kitchen. You know, we work hard and we try to keep our focus, but there's a little bit of, you know, there's a little bit of tongue-in-cheekness to it. There's a little bit of, you know, letting ourselves not get too caught up in, like, the labor of it. And I think that enjoyment kind of extends into the food that you get. It's made with a lot of love. You know, where we can legally listen to music without having to, you know, pay any fees, we play our favorite songs, and there's lots of great philosophical discussion going on behind the scenes, and you know, we hope that comes through in the food that you get here. And yeah, the names for sandwiches are you know, sometimes a little bit less descriptive of what's in them and more so just like a fun title for it. You know, we've got The Silence of the Lambwich, which is sort of a Euro style sandwich. And yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, it's one of the fastest paced jobs I've ever worked, but in the end, it's quite fun.
And Nick, let's talk about one of those sandwiches now. This you've shared this with us. We've got it online at WPR.org/Central Time, plus some of the components involved, the Hedonist sandwich. And wow, there's a lot going on this guy. Tell us a little bit about the Hedonist.
Yeah, so it's the sandwich that really features our country pâté, which is, you know, a liver pâté. It's got a little bit of bacon in there, bringing some smokiness to it. But the sandwich, you know, features some cornichons, little French pickles that, are, you know, got a nice vinegar bite to them, and some onions, but a little mayo mustard. It's really, you know, it's my go-to sandwich for a hangover cure, I'll be honest. It's very rich and decadent, very, it'll leave you feeling like you ate a cheeseburger. You know, it's that kind of a vibe. So yeah, it's definitely a decadent one.
And Ned, as I mentioned, we've got the recipes for the sandwich itself, but also for like the pate. Now, you're part of the deal there is you're a deli. You can buy these components. If I'm not going to smoke the pate at home, I bet I could get something like it there.
Yeah, you absolutely could. And that kind of holds true for a lot of the things in the cookbook here. Like, we want you to have the power to make your own country pate or to smoke your own bison pastrami. But, you know, we also think that the book gives you a kind of a deeper understanding of what's going on in those things if you just want to buy them right out of our deli, where they are readily available.
Now, we've mentioned that you'd like to do Wisconsin products, but not only Wisconsin, but one that comes up a couple times in the book, Nick, is whitefish. Could you talk what goes into making a great smoked whitefish?
You know, it's some patience. You know, it's something that really is special about the whitefish as well is we're scoring the skin, leaving that on while we're smoking. And so talking about how kippering kind of maintains that integrity of the meat, the flesh, is whitefish is a great example of that because it does end up just so buttery and flaky through that process. And it's great that we get it right out of the lake that we sit on, you know.
How do you source your whitefish? Do you just have local people show up, or how do you obtain the whitefish for the smoked whitefish, Ned? So
there's a couple of fishermen that we work with. Lake Superior Fishery, I believe, is the name of Dick Martin's company. But then we'll source from Bodine's as well. They're based on the South Shore. And we're lucky to work with Red Cliff Tribe as well for sourcing some of our lake trout, too. But yeah, it's, you know, we try to stay as local as possible with all of our sourcing.
We're talking to Nick Pelequin and Ned Netzel, co-authors of the new book, Smoke on the Waterfront, the Northern Waters Smokehouse Cookbook. Lots of great advice for the first time smoking efforts to smoke meat or fish, or seasoned professionals. You could join in at 800-642-1234. We're talking about smoking and preserving meat and fish. Is this something you have tried at home that you've done yourself, or maybe visited someone who does? Tell us about it. Tell us about your equipment. Maybe join in with your own advice or your questions or your favorite products. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk about smoking and curing meat and fish with Ned Netzel and Nick Pelequin. They are co-authors of the new cookbook, Smoke on the Waterfront, the Northern Waters Smokehouse Cookbook. Said Smokehouse is in Duluth, Minnesota, right there by Lake Superior. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Now, I thought, sure, some of you smoke things at home. I know that. Maybe you've gotten shy all of a sudden. You've called in the past. Love to hear about your smoking of meat and fish here in Wisconsin or beyond. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Now, Ned, you organize the cookbook by season, which is fun. What is your focus for the winter season in the book?
The winter season is really largely about those large muscle meats. You know, your porchettas, your hams. We've got a bacon recipe in there. Looks like we have the bacon recipe, bison pastrami. It's really, you know, the big cuts and smoking them, braising them, all the things you can do with them, and a little bit about what to do with, you know, your leftovers, or say, you know, you want to use half of it to make a batch of we've got a ham meatballs recipe, and that's kind of the thrust of the winter chapter.
And Nick, one of those winter recipes that caught our eye was pork roulettes. What is a roulette, and how do we smoke it?
So a rillette is actually a little French in there for you. It requires no smoking. It's similar to a confit technique. So you think of like duck confit. It's a very long, slow cook in fat. So it's similar to a braise, but instead of that liquid or stock, you're using fat to kind of impregnate the meat, and it gives it super luscious texture. It's kind of like, you know, a running theme, like how do we preserve the most vitality and integrity of these products and elevate them to their best form, or what we think they can be the best form. And so it's you take that pork, long, slow cook in fat, and then you shred it, and it's just super luscious, rich, you know, something to spread on a piece of crusty bread.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. We've got Chris in Duluth. Hi, Chris.
Hello. Yes, this is Chris. I'm calling from Duluth. I just wanted to say, first of all, that I really appreciate the work of the Northern Waters guys, and I had a lot of positive experiences bringing my own personal fish to be smoked. They do an awesome custom smoke. I've brought in rainbow trout that they smoked up for me. And then after doing that many times, I thought, well, why don't I just try this myself? And I got to give credit to them for encouraging me and just giving me the motivation to make it happen. And I've really enjoyed picking up the trade. And it's actually not that hard, and it's a really fun experiment. And I find every time I get a little bit better, and do a lot of whitefish netting in the Boundary Waters, and I've had a good experience smoking my own whitefish and lake trout and rainbow trout. So guys, thank you for giving us all the motivation to go give it a shot ourselves.
Chris, thanks a lot for that call. Ned, this is something you all do there, help other people figure out how to do it themselves?
Yeah, I mean, the power is yours to make amazing food, and we just want to help people along as well as we can. You know, long before we had a cookbook, or before having a cookbook was even a possibility, you know, if people wanted to know the secrets to how we do things, Eric, our owner, has always been very forthcoming with that information, because, you know, why wouldn't you want to encourage people to make great food? And yeah.
Chris, thanks a lot for calling in at 800-642-1234. Now, Nick, we heard there Chris harvests his own whitefish, but for people doing this at home who maybe don't hunt or fish themselves, what recommendations do you have for them when they're looking for a source of fish or pork or what have you to find something that's going to work great in their home smoking operation?
You know, looking for a local butcher shop, that's going to be your best bet, kind of build a personal relationship with someone. That being said, I mean, there's some great mail services now that ship direct from fishermen either in Alaska or along the coasts. Those can be great sources, and, you know, they'll get it to you overnight with some freezer packs in there. Otherwise, you know, a lot of chain grocery stores, they're carrying some pretty quality meat in their butchery section. So, you know, any piece of salmon you get at the grocery store, you can smoke it. It's you know, it'll take to the same treatment. Most of it is going to be a pretty good quality fish if they're selling it commercially. So
We are talking to Ned Netzel and Nick Pelequin on Food Friday. They're a couple of the co-authors of the book, Smoke on the Waterfront, the Northern Waters Smokehouse Cookbook. Northern Waters Smokehouse there in Duluth. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ned, of course, the reason we started as humans smoking things was to preserve them. How can you talk a little bit about how smoked meat preserves? Do we put it in the fridge after we do it at home? How does that all work?
So with the fish, the way we're telling you how to smoke it here, the smoking, you know, it is preservative in a sense. We kind of do it more as a culinary flourish. It's more of a flavor than anything. So you're not going to want to leave the fish that you're smoking the way we're doing it out of the refrigerator. But you know, once it's in the refrigerator, you know, you got weeks that you can keep it, you know, rather than maybe a couple days or a week. And yeah, I mean, just the amount of salt and sugar and the smoke itself help to extend that shelf life of your piece of fish. There, I'm sure are, you know, you could make some sort of jerky out of salmon. That's not really what we're into. But with other kinds of meats, you know, if you get most of the moisture out of it, it'll keep, and it could be even, you know, shelf stable in the case of like a beef jerky or something. But yeah, it extends the life. It gives it a great flavor. Yeah.
And Nick, a lot of the recipes here, you know, the smoked meat or fish is the star of the recipe. It is not the only player in the recipe. How do you go about figuring out, you know, what is going to pair well with this smoked product?
You know, it's kind of any classic pairing with anything that you would think of when it comes to a charcuterie. So, you know, pickles are going to, you know, cut through that fat and that richness and that smokiness. You know, same thing with a jam or something, bringing some of that sweetness, a little acidity. You want to play to, you know, kind of opposites almost. You want to round out your flavor wheel, so to speak. So you want to find those complementary flavors that are also going to contrast.
And Ned, what, this is probably a terrible question to ask you because you've been at this a long time. Is there a recipe or a couple recipes that have really stood out to you that this is like, yeah, this is one that I want to share with people. I enjoy myself, kind of a rock star that you use to as an ambassador for smoked meats.
Oh gosh. I mean, I think that smoked duck breast is one of the best flavors I can think of. And we've got a section in our book that we call the duck sequence, which kind of takes one whole duck or multiple ideally, and breaks it down into its constituent, you know, components, and then tries to do as much as you possibly can with it, including like confying the legs, smoking the breasts, making a stock out of the carcass. And I mean, that might be it. Like a smoked duck breast is pretty unreal. It's like an elevated form of the same kind of flavors you're going to get from like a bacon. But really our smoked fish recipe is, it's pretty phenomenal. You know, we have people, layer on the, you know, this is the best smoked salmon I've ever had. And we hope that that's true. And we hope that we do a really good job, but you know, I would say our smoked salmon recipe in this cookbook or that duck sequence are really great indicators of what you can do with smoke and temperature and all those kinds of things.
And Nick, just in our last couple of moments, is there something you're working on to expand the horizons of smoked meat and fish in a new recipe?
Something we're working to expand the horizons. Oh, man.
Like a new experiment or something like that.
Let's see. You know, it's funny. We actually just made some homemade hot dogs today down at the smokehouse. But we're always playing around. You know, there's tons of stuff we like to do. We'd love to bring back some whole muscle meat dry cures. As far as smoking goes, though, man.
Sticking with the basics.
Oh, you know, we just got a leg sturgeon. So, we're playing around with that. Come check it out when we have that in stock.
usually on the weekend.
Thanks to our guests. We've been talking to Ned Netzel and Nick Pelequin. They are co-authors of Smoke on the Waterfront, the Northern Waters Smokehouse Cookbook. They joined us on Food Friday. You could find a recipe they shared for the Hedonist Sandwich and a couple of the components of that. We've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. Join us Monday at noon live from the Capitol Rotunda as we celebrate the life and legacy of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It's Wisconsin's 43rd annual tribute and ceremony. WPR's Jonathan Overby hosts our nation's oldest official MLK state commemoration. That's coming up Monday at noon. You could tune in here on Wisconsin Public Radio or online at WPR.org. Here's a new discovery in space that was led in part by two UW-Madison researchers. It's a planet that has a few things in common with Earth. According to a UW press release, the newly described planet is called HD63433D after the star it orbits around. Just like Earth, it's the third planet from its sun, and it's the closest Earth-like planet that's been discovered outside our solar system. But don't start packing just yet. For one thing, closest doesn't mean close. It's still 72 light years away. In human terms, that's really far. For another, the planet is probably tidally locked, meaning the same side faces the sun all the time. The planet is way closer to the sun there than the Earth is here. So your daytime side is going to be around 2300 degrees Fahrenheit. The other side, always dark. Also, the planet is so close to the star, it orbits once every 4.2 days. So 4.2 days equals 1 year there. If I lived on that planet, somehow I'd be over 4,600 years old. Not sure how I feel about that. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A new pilot program at Madison's East High School will offer a different way for teachers to formally evaluate first-year students' performance in the classroom. The standards-based approach to grading represents a gradual but significant shift away from using the letters system most of us grew up with on those tests maybe every week, A through F. They're not the first school in the area to try it. Some middle schools have already given it a go. The district is going to evaluate how the pilot works for the classes involved to see whether it could be a good fit to roll out to more classes and to more schools. We're first going to talk with our reporter who covered the story. Then we'll hear from a couple of the people at Madison High School about how this actually looks and works in practice. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about schools transitioning away from a letter-based grading scale? Are you a teacher, parent, or student who has some experience with this standards-based system? How has it been working? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Corey Hess covers education for WPR. Corey, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
I gave some very basics there. Give us a few more basics. How does this standard-based system work in schools that have been trying it and to be piloted at Madison East?
Well, like you said, it's different than what we're used to. Students won't, in this pilot program, receive A, B, C's like we're all used to. Instead, they'll be getting grades that look like advanced for an A or, you know, emerging instead of a D. But it's not really as simple as just a shift like that. So the idea of standards-based grading is that it gives students more of a chance to see how they're progressing. So for example, getting a B is more of a points-based system. You know, it's 80 to 90 points. But getting labeled proficient tells a student that they're meeting learning targets, but they still have some room to grow. So supporters say that students, you know, they're getting more feedback with this type of grading.
One question that popped into my head, I imagine a lot of people would think about, like, wait a minute, if people are applying to college, don't they want to see grades? At the end of the year, yes, they do. Students will still end up with a letter grade, as I understand it from your reporting, Corey.
They will. Yes, they'll still get that traditional letter grade. But, you know, in talking to the people in Madison and to others, colleges are used to this. They're getting more and more used to it because this is becoming more of a popular thing. So these students will still get letter grades, but this isn't as radical as we might think because we're used to seeing letter grades. It's just kind of a new way of education. And which is always changing.
Yeah. And Madison isn't the first school, even the first school in Wisconsin to do this. How many others around Wisconsin have given this a try?
You know, there's a handful. Milwaukee Public Schools, McFarland School District, School District of Baraboo have been doing this. And then starting this year, the Racine Unified School District. And then just over the border in Illinois, there's a lot of suburban school districts that have been doing this for several years.
And Corey, can you talk a little more about the why that you heard from the people involved in this in Madison and who have tried it elsewhere?
Yeah, again, the why is just that it puts a primary focus more on learning and giving students multiple opportunities to demonstrate what they have mastered and then what they still need to work on instead of just this concrete grade and concrete points. So they just have a little bit, you know, more, it's not so black and white, like in their face. It's just more of focusing on learning. And, you know, another thing is this, they're not being graded on behavior and on homework. It takes out some of the traditional things.
Corey, thanks for sharing your reporting with us.
Thanks, Rob.
Corey Hess covers education for WPR. Now we're going to bring in a couple of the people responsible for implementing this change at Madison East High School. Jocelyn Lipinski is assistant principal and scheduling principal of Madison East. Jocelyn, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob.
And Megan Willauer teaches ninth grade algebra, is multilingual education department chair, and is part of the ninth grade leadership team at Madison East High School. Megan, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having us.
Jocelyn, I want to start with you. This is a significant shift. Can you talk about the process that led up to this pilot program?
Sure. Just to be clear, this process did not start right last summer. I began my career at Capitol High, and I want to just point out that Capitol High in Madison, as one of the six high schools, has been doing this work for a long time as well. That's where I started, and I got a ton of experience with them. And pretty much during that time is when the team that Megan's on, the math team, began to start looking at this stuff and began to play around with standards-based grading. And, you know, as much as I was doing it at Capitol High, they were doing it at East. So this has been years of work before it became what everyone is calling a pilot.
And Megan, what was it about standards-based grading assessment that appealed to you as a possibility to try out?
I think when the algebra team and some of the other courses that are taught in ninth grade, the teachers got together and started talking about standards-based learning, what really appealed to us was the ability for us to hone in on specific skills and pieces of knowledge and what students know and are able to do, and being able to better communicate that to the students and their families so that we could say, for example, a student maybe is able to write a linear equation, but representing it graphically is not something they're able to do yet. And then we can give more specific feedback on that skill rather than just saying you have a B, which doesn't get into the skills or pieces of knowledge that the students have.
Megan, can you talk about working with Jocelyn and Jocelyn, can you talk about working with Megan and the other teachers, you know, to figure out how to give that kind of feedback? Because it is a little different than writing a B on the page after you figured out the number.
It absolutely is. And I will say, like, again, it's the teachers doing this work. They come together and it is more than just feedback on the work. They also are analyzing student work together. They're essentially heading in the same direction together. I think this is a big shift for teachers, too, who they're not all siloed in their classrooms trying to figure out how to teach algebra. They're collectively deciding this is what we want students to know and be able to do, and this is how we're going to get there as a team. And so that's together is where they can hone that stuff. And then as well, they practice the feedback on the work. And we really encourage teachers in the classrooms to give real-time feedback to the kiddos. And that's exactly what Megan said, is you can do this thing, but this other one, you're just not there yet. And that's a huge mind shift for us.
Megan, suppose I'm magically transported into that ninth grade algebra class, and I'm not breaking out in a cold sweat. I think that's a good thing. talk about my experience. When would I see these evaluations on my homework, on tests, things like that? From a student's eye view, what is it going to look like?
So we have four different levels that we talk about pretty consistently: advanced, proficient, developing, and emerging. And students are constantly being asked to self-assess where they think they are. As we go over problems, as we look at work, we talk about what a proficient answer would look like or sound like. We talk about what an answer might need to be able to be bumped up to the next level to be advanced. And then students mid-unit, as we're studying something, we give something we call standards checks, which is essentially what people would think of as a quiz, but the grade on that assessment doesn't actually change their grade in the grade book. It's a piece of feedback. So this week I had students take a standards check. They got their score advanced, proficient, developing, or emerging with some really specific feedback on what they need to continue to practice for our upcoming test. So our test is next week, and they now have a better idea of what they want to practice before that assessment coming up.
And Megan, what has the response been for your students seeing a different thing written on top of that that quiz?
Well, since we teach ninth graders and they're coming from a standards-based model in middle school,
not a surprise.
It's been a pretty easy transition. They understand that these levels are really tracking continuous growth, and that it means that they have an opportunity to continue to improve their learning and understanding.
And Jocelyn, based at your experience at, as you mentioned, Capital High School in Madison, did you find that students were learning better? They were grasping the material more with this system.
Yeah. The unique thing is what Megan was getting at there, which is that it does put some of the ownership and the autonomy on our student to say, this is what I can do and this is what I can't do yet. And I think that's a huge thing away from, you know, the notions in the movies and everything where students are memorizing dates and all that stuff. It's not about dates anymore. It's about, you know, what I am able to know and do through the content. And I think that frees up our teachers quite a bit. From being stuck with content that's been around for 100 years.
We're talking about a program at Madison East High School in some classes for first-year students that phases out letter grades for day-to-day use and uses a different approach, standards-based approach, for teachers to evaluate student performance and help them get better at the stuff that they need to get better at. We're talking to two members of the Madison East staff, the assistant principal in charge of managing the program, Jocelyn Lipinski, and ninth grade algebra teacher Megan Willauer, who's working with it in the classroom. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Does this sound pretty different than the schooling you're used to as a student, a parent, maybe a teacher yourself? Does it sound good? Or have you tried this before? Have you experienced this yourself? What questions do you have about how this all works? Join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Assistant Principal Jocelyn Lipinski and ninth grade algebra teacher Megan Willauer from Madison East High School, talking about a program there in some classes for first-year students that's phasing out traditional letter grades on tests in favor of what's called a standards-based system of rating students' proficiency in different subjects, finding the things that they need to improve. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. John is with us in Lake Halley. John, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I am actually a teacher of ninth grade algebra right now, and I like the idea of standard-based teaching, but what do you do with students that just do any work whatsoever or disappear?
John, thanks for the call. I think John was cutting out there a bit, wondering what, Megan, what you do if those students refuse to do the work under a standards-based program.
So in my experience, students want to be successful and want to learn, and we really focus on meeting students where they are at. And I have found that my students will engage with some of the content in some way. So I have been lucky enough that I've never had a student completely refuse to do algebra. I've always been able to find some skills that they are willing to work on and develop that they can continue to learn and grow in.
John, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Jocelyn, a student not wanting to do their work could be a problem in an A through F system or a standards-based system. With your experience with this at another high school, did you see students maybe a little more motivated to do the work?
That's a great question. I think, student motivation. I think the unique thing of this system is that you're not there yet. And I think that frees up some of the students. You're not caught in that like F range. You're not caught in feeling bad about yourself. It's really more about like what you want to learn and be able to do. And I know I keep repeating that, but again, that feels different for me, as a supervisor when I'm seeing that kind of stuff versus I'm seeing, you know, students with a whole bunch of F's and D's.
Thanks for that call. Aaron is with us now in Madison. Aaron, hello.
Hi. My question is, this just kind of feels like a facelift. Like A is proficient, B is intermediate, and it seems not super, it just feels like a facelift. How much of it really is the name change from A to proficient versus teachers just giving more feedback, more tailored feedback?
Aaron, thanks a lot for the call. And I will admit that when I saw this, I thought if I was a cynical student, which I was back in the day, I'd say advanced. Oh, that's an A. Proficient. Oh, that's a B. Persuade that cynical young Rob, Megan, that this is really something different.
So I think a couple of things. The traditional grading system is so ingrained in our culture and how we grew up as adults and how we were assessed. So it is going to take some time for us to shift, and it's a cultural shift for students then as well. But what I really kind of lean back on when I think about why we're making this shift is when I was grading students in a traditional system and it was out of points, like Corey reported on earlier, thinking about a student accumulating points, they were accumulating random points that might not have necessarily been tied to specific skills. And if they earned enough points, they got to that particular grade. And now instead, we have really clear criteria that we've co-created on rubrics that in order to earn proficient, you need to be able to demonstrate these skills. And if you aren't able to show all of those skills, you are not earning that score yet, and you need more opportunities to practice and show it. So I think the standards-based system and the rubrics we've created and the assessments we've created are holding students to a higher standard than just accumulating points.
Aaron, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We heard it from a caller named Jim who couldn't stay on the line. Jim wonders, what motivates the students to do homework? If there aren't grades, what does this do for students who are struggling to keep up? Jocelyn, I think sometimes there's the idea that, okay, that grade, well, gives me something to strive for. I want to hit that A. Do you see that as a loss? Do you see that as maybe taking away motivation, as Jim is concerned?
Well, what I often argue is if grades were a motivating factor, then all students would be getting A's, B's, and C's, because I believe that all students wake up in the morning and want to earn those grades. But I think that that's a punitive system of sorts that we are all caught in. And again, I have to shift my mindset to think about that and give students the space and time to learn the skills that we agree as a school and as a group of teachers are important for our students to know. So as far as motivation, all kids want to learn. And in this case, it actually makes the environment a little safer that they are getting that direct feedback instead of some test that comes back with a red letter F on the top, which tells you nothing other than, you know, you are not a good student.
We are talking to Megan Willauer at Madison East High School and Jocelyn Lipinski. Megan's a teacher, Jocelyn a principal there, talking about working with standards-based evaluation of students, and instead of getting that letter grade on everything you do, a guideline, ways to find out what students need to get better at. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Megan, one thing I wonder from the teacher's perspective is, it sounds like this might take more time that teachers may not have a lot of. Does it seem like it's increasing a workload?
Yeah, I appreciate that question. I think my answer is no. I don't think it's an increased workload, I think it's shifting my attention and helping me to prioritize what we are teaching and how we are teaching it. And I feel really fortunate the team that I work with, being able to collaborate with them and help to kind of divide up the work and really think through and share ideas and share practices, has made this a more efficient system for me.
And Jocelyn, a point I mentioned earlier, as I understand it, this all gets translated into a letter grade at the end of the year. So that's, say, for that college application, things like that, the grade is on the transcript. How important was it to do this? Was there some pushback along the lines of like, well, you got to have a letter at the end of the day?
I mean, yes and no. That's a really good question. Our district, as it stands right now, it sort of had to have a letter grade on the end, and that's okay from our standpoint. There's no way we can exist outside of that system. And that's okay. And I think it helps students. At the end of the day, again, it's all these kids in these classes that are getting this different experience about what they can and can't do. And they go from there.
Megan, if there are teachers or administrators from other districts around the state listening right now saying, okay, yeah, this sounds kind of cool, how would you recommend they get started looking into it, researching it, and maybe working to make it a reality?
I think having the right team in place is really important, and starting to have conversations with teams around philosophy, around grading, about what we believe grades are meant to communicate, and what we want students to be able to show in their learning by the end of a course, and starting there and thinking through what those standards might be, and then going backwards, how do we get students to that point to be able to demonstrate proficiency in all of those skills? So I think the team, the collaborative team piece, is the first step.
And Jocelyn, as you mentioned, you've been working with some standards-based evaluation for a while. Are you at a point where you're ready to evangelize and suggest to other school districts, yeah, you should give this a look and maybe give it a shot?
I love that question. Yes, if we are talking about evangelizing around student-centered teaching and having students feel welcome in the classroom and, focus on their own autonomy and competence, then yes, I'm all for that. Because I think Megan's right. You have to start talking about that work in a collaborative team first, to buy into this stuff. So yes, I'd love to go around the country and do that kind of work, Rob, if that's what it meant.
And Megan, for the rest of the school year, do you, as you enter this term, do you see students ready to rock and learn and, you know, improve on that one thing in algebra that they're just that they're striking out on so far?
Yes, I'm seeing students talk about specific skills or things that they want to improve on. I'm seeing a lot of students experience success. We are finishing up semester one really strong and looking forward to making small shifts semester two and continuing to learn from the pilot.
Thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Jocelyn Lipinski, assistant principal and scheduling principal of Madison East High School, and Megan Willauer, who teaches ninth grade algebra and is multilingual education department chair. We talked to them today about a program they're working on for a standards-based approach to grading in a handful of classes at the high school, with less emphasis on day-to-day letter grades, more emphasis on skills to develop in algebra or all the other classes. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, if you're looking for a good book, we've got some help on the way. Get great recommendations that you might have missed from 2023. Get a preview of big books out in 2024. You can get started now if you've got a book recommendation. Email ideas@wpr.org. Plus, we'll talk to the author of the new book, Unshrinking, How to Face Fat Phobia, about persistent bias against people based on their weight and their appearance, and how to overcome it. That and more Monday on Central Time.